So yesterday our family was doing a family time that involved a little bit of hiking, lunch, some different fun things out and around town in Daniels Park. And one of our children, I won't say who it was, but he was kind of struggling with one area of obedience. And if you're parents, you've probably had this nearly exact experience where you say, you can't do this or you can't talk this way. And they're like, okay, yeah, yeah. And then it happens again, the exact same thing. And you offer some kind of warning of like, no, I'm warning you, you can't talk this way, you can't do this. And they get a little bit more serious, like, okay, I will never do it again. I will stop. And then it's again and again. And each time it's like, okay, I get it. This time I get it. And I'm done and I'm not going to do that again. And then finally you're like, okay, next time there's going to literally have to be discipline. Okay, I get it. And I'm more serious right now than I've ever been that I am not going to do that thing. And then, of course, it happens again. Okay, so y'all been there spiritually with God where you do the same thing, you say the same thing, and maybe it's an attitude that you fall into where it's fear or anger or doubting him or something like that, and you go through this cycle, right? And I think in moments even of genuine brokenness, and I'm not questioning your sincerity, but you're like, God, I am so sick and tired of this thing. And I just want to be done with it, and I want to get over it, and I'm more serious now about being over it and never doing that again than I've ever been in my whole life. Okay, how'd that go for you? So this morning we come to a story in Nehemiah 9 and 10, where what I want us to do this morning is I want us to compare the strength of the best and the sincerest promises that we could ever make to God with the strength of the promise that he makes to us. And then ask you, what at the end of the day is your hope? And what at the end of the day are you hanging on to as, that's how I know I'm going to be okay? Because I've made this promise to God and I've meant it deeper and more sincerely than I ever have before, or because I have this, not just a promise, but a list of promises from God. So let's go. Nehemiah 9 is the longest prayer in the Bible, and we're going to read it. So it's not that long. I don't think by just cherry-picking some verses and saying, do you see the theme, that we're going to get what we want, versus you just hearing the weight and the joy that is contained in this prayer. And what I want you to listen for in particular is that there's a cycle of something that's going to happen five times. So Ezra and Nehemiah, these spiritual leaders of Israel, along with these Levites, who are kind of like their ancient elders, they're leading the people in this prayer, and they're going to talk about the history of Israel, the history of God's people. And you're going to see something repeated basically five times over. I want you to listen for what that is. Now, we're going to jump in about verse 6 where the prayer actually begins, but I want you to notice these leaders of Israel, verse 5, so Nehemiah 9, 5, are saying, stand up and bless the Lord your God from everlasting to everlasting. So he's always been, he always will be. They're saying, blessed be your glorious name, which is exalted above all blessing and praise. So anything that we could ever think to praise, your name is high above all of that. So verse 6, you are the Lord, you alone. You have made heaven, the heaven of heavens, with all their host, the earth and all that is on it, the seas and all that is in them, and you preserve all of them. And the host of heaven worships you. You are the Lord, the God who chose Abram and brought him out of Ur of the Chaldeans and gave him the name Abraham. You found his heart faithful before you and made with him the covenant to give his offspring the land of the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Perizzite, the Jebusite, and the Girgashite. And you have kept your promise, for you are righteous. And you saw the affliction of our fathers in Egypt and heard their cry at the Red Sea and performed signs and wonders against Pharaoh and all his servants and all the people of his land, for you knew that they acted arrogantly against our fathers. And you made a name for yourself, as it is to this day. And you divided the sea before them, so that they went through the midst of the sea on dry land. And you cast their pursuers into the depths as a stone into mighty waters. By a pillar of cloud you led them in the day, and by a pillar of fire in the night, to light for them the way in which they should go. You came down on Mount Sinai, and you spoke with them from heaven, and you gave them right rules and true laws, good statutes and commandments. And you made known to them your holy Sabbath and commanded them commandments and statutes and a law by Moses your servant. You gave them bread from heaven for their hunger, and you brought water for them out of a rock for their thirst. And you told them to go in to possess the land that you had sworn to give them. But they and our fathers acted presumptuously and stiffened their neck and did not obey your commandments. They refused to obey and were not mindful of the wonders that you performed among them, but they stiffened their neck and they appointed a leader to return to their slavery in Egypt. But you are a God ready to forgive, gracious and merciful, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love, and did not forsake them. Even when they had made for themselves a golden calf and said, "This is your God who brought you up out of Egypt," and had committed great blasphemies, you and your great mercies did not forsake them in the wilderness. The pillar of cloud to lead them in the way did not depart from them by day, nor did the pillar of fire by night to light for them the way by which they should go. You gave your good spirit to instruct them and did not withhold your manna from their mouth, and you gave them water for their thirst. 40 years you sustained them in the wilderness, and they lacked nothing. Their clothes did not wear out, and their feet did not swell. And you gave them kingdoms and peoples and allotted to them every corner. So they took possession of the land of Sihon, king of Heshbon, and the land of Og, king of Bashan. You multiplied their children as the stars of heaven, and you brought them into the land that you had told their fathers to enter and possess. So the descendants went in and possessed the land, and you subdued before them the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, and you gave them into their hand for their kings and the peoples of the land that they might do with them as they would. And you captured fortified cities and a rich land and took possession of houses full of good things, cisterns already hewn, vineyards, olive orchards, and fruit trees in abundance. So they ate and were filled and became fat and delighted themselves in your great goodness. Nevertheless, they were disobedient and rebelled against you and cast your law behind their back and killed your prophets who had warned them in order to turn back to you. And they committed great blasphemies. Therefore, you gave them into the hand of their enemies who made them suffer. And in the time of their suffering, they cried out to you, and you heard them from heaven. And according to your great mercies, you gave them saviors who saved them from the hand of their enemies. But after they had rest, they did evil again before you. And you abandoned them into the hand of their enemies so that they had dominion over them. Yet when they turned and cried to you, you heard from heaven, and many times you delivered them according to your mercies, and you warned them in order to turn them back to your law, yet they acted presumptuously and did not obey your commandments, but sinned against your rules, which if a person does them, he shall live by them. And they turned a stubborn shoulder and stiffened their neck and would not obey. Many years you bore with them and warned them by your spirit through your prophets, yet they would not give ear. Therefore, you gave them into the hand of the peoples of the lands. Nevertheless, in your great mercies, you did not make an end of them or forsake them, for you are a gracious and merciful God. Now, therefore, our God, the great, the mighty, and the awesome God who keeps covenant and steadfast love, let not all the hardship seem little to you that has come upon us, upon our kings, our princes, our priests, our prophets, our fathers, and all your people since the time of the kings of Assyria until this day. Yet you have been righteous in all that has come upon us, for you have dealt faithfully, and we have acted wickedly. Our kings, our princes, our priests, and our fathers have not kept your law or paid attention to your commandments and your warnings that you gave them, even in their own kingdom, enjoying your great goodness that you gave them in the large and rich land you set before them. They did not serve you or turn from their wicked works. Behold, we are slaves this day in the land that you gave to our fathers to enjoy its fruit and its good gifts. Behold, we are slaves. And its rich yield goes to the kings whom you have set over us because of our sins. They rule over our bodies and over our livestock as they please, and we are in great distress. Because of all of this, we make a firm covenant in writing on the sealed document are the names of our princes, our Levites, and our priests. This is the word of the Lord. I mean, what a great and awesome prayer. And I want us just to briefly unpack this morning. And I want to show you kind of two lists of fives to lead this off. First of all, the very beginning, as he begins this prayer, he kind of lays a little bit of groundwork where he says five really critical things. Basically saying, number one, you are the only God. Number two, you are the creator and the sustainer of everything. Number three, he's saying, you chose us to be your people. We didn't choose you. This is the whole Abram thing. Like, you went to this guy who was a pagan, and you're like, come with me. I'm going to make a great people of you. Actually, you're going to be the father of many nations, Abraham. Number four, they say, you made a covenant with gracious promises to us. Number five, he says, you are righteous. Now, that's great. But did you notice the cycles? I mean, if you've read the book of Judges, this is a very familiar cycle, is it not? That you see the people, first of all, verses 9 through 21, it's that Exodus generation, the people that God delivered with a mighty hand, with a strong arm, with all these plagues and miracles. And he's like, you parted an ocean for them so that they came through on dry ground, and you gave them your law so that they could know who you are and what you expect of them and how they can be right with you. And you provided food and drink, and you did all these wonderful things, and they rebelled. And you see it again, verses 22 through 27, verse 28, verses 29 through 31, verses 32 through 37, with that current generation. Is over and over again, you see this cycle. And by the way, what attributes of God, as I read through that, what kind of jumps out at you? And maybe even just write down a few words of like, this is what stood out to me in this cycle. We keep hearing some of the same words, some of the same themes. And that's kind of this. God is kind to his people. And he's not kind because they deserve that kindness. He's kind just because he's kind. That's just the kind of God that he is. And you see, in response to that kindness, the people start getting kind of fat and happy. They get presumptuous. They rebel against God. They get miserable. They cry out to God, help. And God is merciful and gracious. So this morning, we're going to be talking about this grace of God. And number one, what we see in this text is the preeminence of grace. The preeminence of grace. That probably jumped out at you in this passage, in this prayer. What they're rehearsing is, we did it again where we failed you. We let you down. We rebelled. We went the other way. When you were doing us only good, this is the history of our people. And yet, you were kind. You were merciful. You forgave us. You bore with us in your love. Great mercies. Not just you're merciful. Great mercies. Verse 17, 19, 27, 28, 31. The preeminence of that grace of God. Because in this prayer, and I think in the character of God, in the dealings of God with man, that's one of the foremost attributes that we should ever notice, is that God is gracious. He doesn't always give us. He doesn't often give us what we deserve. But he's merciful. He's kind. Instead. And by the way, I think that our culture, and especially our more recent generations, we gravitate toward that side of God, don't we? I mean, when you read this prayer, you're like, oh, God's pretty cool, even in the Old Testament. Now, if you got down into the nitty-gritty of some of those stories, there might be things that you're like, I like that. But when you read a prayer about, we stink, and God was merciful, and we did it again, and we rebelled, and we were terrible, and we were worse than the time before, and God was merciful. And we're like, yeah, I mean, that resonates with me. That resonates with our culture, that there would be a merciful, loving, patient, forgiving, kind, second opportunities, and third opportunities, and 100th opportunities kind of God. But that brings us to point two very quickly, the problem with grace. And I put the word problem in quotation marks because I want you to understand I'm not actually saying that there's a problem with grace per se. You'll understand this as I share. But the problem with grace, in the way I mean it, is that first of all, we tend to presume upon it and we tend to demand it. And you see that in this text where God's people kept sinning, and Nehemiah is even confessing this later. We acted presumptuously. Like, it was so good for so long. We just took that grace for granted, and we're like, God's always going to be gracious. You know, and it's like, we can go as far as we want down this path, and we can do our thing, and we can check out some other idols and see how that goes, and we can kind of sin with a high hand. I mean, we know the law, but we want to do these things. So we're going to dabble in that. And if we get ourselves in too deep, God will do what he's always done and he'll save us. So the problem with grace, the first problem is that we tend to presume upon it and demand it. I've shared this illustration before, but in college, where and some of you are in college, you're in high school, you're about to get that big syllabus, right? At the beginning of the first day of class, and the professors hand you, this is my list of expectations for you this semester. Here are your assignments. And having a teacher that said, basically, here are your assignments. You know, you're going to have quizzes, you're going to have tests, but there are three major projects in this class. One of them is due on September 30th, one is due on October 30th, and one is due on November 30th. And when you come to class, that paper is due. Okay? If you don't turn it in by noon on the day that it's due, you get an automatic F, and I'm not even going to read it. So the first month rolls around, September 30th, and you know, in this class of 250, 225 people turn in that paper, and 25 do not. And the 25 are sitting there like, please, 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 please. I underestimated how hard this transition from high school to college was going to be. I'm still juggling this thing because all my other teachers have tests and projects today, because that's what always happened. It was Friday and it was all due on the same day, right? And I should have planned ahead. It's my fault, but you know, will you please, 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 please just give us a little bit of mercy? And the professor says, okay, I'll tell you what, I will extend my deadline 24 hours. If it's in my credenza by noon tomorrow, I will grade it as if you turned it in on time. Oh, you are a wonderful teacher. You're the best professor on campus. No one does this for us. You're so, so, so wonderful. Thank you so much. And people, you know, write furiously because they haven't even started yet, you know. And they write their paper, they turn it in, they get their A's and B's and C's, but not F's. And a month later, project number two rolls around. And for project number two on October 30th, 75 students didn't turn it in. And they're like, oh, teacher, you know how like last month you gave us that extension, that extra 24 hours? And like right now we're in kind of that middle part of the semester where like it's just busy, right? And we're having a hard time keeping up. We kind of adjusted to the workload, but there was this, you know, there was this program last night and I had a date at that and I just, you know, I couldn't do it. And so one more time, the professor says, okay, 24-hour extension. If it's in my credenza tomorrow by noon, I'll grade it as if it were on time. Oh, you're just literally the most wonderful teacher we've ever had. I mean, at any level. And month three rolls around and 150 kids don't have the assignment done. And the teacher says, well, all of you who didn't turn in an assignment get an F. Well, aren't you going to extend it 24 hours? No, I'm not. No, I've already done that twice. And of course, what's the cry of the college student in hearing this? That's not fair. And the teacher said, oh, so you want what's fair. Mr. Johnson, what grade did you get on that first assignment? Well, I got a B. Okay, well, now you have an F. Because that's what's fair. And see, we don't want what's fair. We want grace. Right? We want the patience. We want the forbearance. We want the second and third and fifth chance. And the problem is something's wrong with us. Something's not wrong with grace. Something's wrong with us where we take it so lightly and we come to demand it, to expect it. And anything less than the full grace of God, we're like, that's not fair. Well, yeah, it is. A second problem with grace that's related to this is simply that grace is only one side of the story. And if you read this prayer and you read it thoughtfully, what is the problem with thinking, I can do this, I can sin with a high hand, I can sin presumptuously, I can do whatever I want, and if I want to turn around because I'm in a pit and I can't get myself out, God will always deliver me. What's the problem with thinking that way? God will always deliver me. God will always be gracious and merciful. Well, the problem is that his grace is only a part of his character. What other attribute of God does he reflect on here? Verse 8, verse 33. God, you're righteous. In other words, you're just. And if God is really just, friends, we have a problem. Because if God is really just, if he's really righteous, how can he continue to extend only mercy and only grace? See, if these people of God, and if we continue to blaspheme, continue to fail, continue to heap mud on the name of God, because we're like, yeah, I'm a Christian, follow Jesus, and then just everybody knows, like, you're worldly, you're carnal, you live like everybody else. I mean, yes, God can be merciful, and God many times will be merciful, but there's another side to this story. How can God continue to pass over so much sin, so much rebellion, so much idolatry? How could he do it back then? How can he do it today? We have a problem. Now, beginning in chapter 9, verse 38, and I ended here, the people of God have a really brilliant solution. Okay, so they're recognizing this. God, you are merciful and gracious, and you're steadfast in your love, and you're forgiving. You're all those things, yes, but you are righteous. And that means you need to punish us at some point. So they say, verse 38, okay, we have a solution to this righteousness of God problem. They're saying, not only will we keep the old covenant that no one before us kept, we'll make a new covenant to keep the covenant. That's what they're doing. I mean, all of chapter 10, they're sitting here, and I'll just point out a couple of verses, because there's a bunch of names. These are the leaders of different families and households that are signing it on behalf of their family. But verse 29 of chapter 10, I mean, they're joining together, and they're saying, like, we'll enter into a curse and an oath to walk in God's law that was given by Moses. So what do they do? We'll take a covenant to keep the covenant. And if you were to read all of chapter 10, there's basically three big chunks to this new promise, this new covenant. Verses 29 through 30, they're like, we will keep God's law. Absolutely. I mean, look at this. We will observe and do all the commandments of the Lord, our Lord, and his rules and statutes. Okay, so we'll keep the law. Verse 31, they're like, we'll keep God's day. You know, that Sabbath day, that special day, we'll not only keep the law, we'll keep the day. And then the rest of the chapter is, and we'll keep God's house. Okay, so his law, his day, his house, we will guard it, we will observe it in a way that nobody ever has. And I don't think the people lack sincerity. I don't think that they're just like, we got to get God off our back. We got to get God to do us a solid, you know, so what do we need to say? Okay, God, new covenant to keep the old covenant. We really, really, really mean it. I think they're sincere. And I don't think there's anything wrong per se with them or with us saying, Lord, I want to recommit myself to listen to your word and to do what it says. That's a good thing. So what's the problem? The problem is, do you really think that this generation, after this cycle of failure after failure after failure after failure, do you think this first generation is going to be the first one that actually does it? I mean, the odds are not good that they're going to be the first generation that's like, we mean it, and we're somehow qualitatively different than every generation that went before us. They're not. People are people. So here's the second problem with grace, as I put it this way. If God is righteous and just as well as merciful and gracious, what is our hope if we continue to sin? Because in a sense, he can kind of kick the can of justice down the road. He can delay it. He can forbear. He can be patient and long-suffering like he tells us to be with one another. But at some point in time, you got to pay your bill. Or God is not just. He's merciful, but he's not just. Because there's this debt piling up and piling up and piling up. And what could we ever offer for ourselves to atone for that debt that we've piled up? And by the way, this is religion. This is all religion. Whether it's the Eightfold Path of Buddhism, or the Five Pillars of Islam, or the Four Aims of Hinduism, or the Seven Sacraments of Catholicism, or even the Ten Commandments of Judaism. What does religion do? It says, do this, you do this, and this is what makes you right with God. How's that going for you? If he's really just, if he's really righteous, if he really knows not only the things that you do, but the things that you would do if you felt like you could get away with it. Or the things that you think and you wish you could do in your heart, but you know better than to act on them. Because you don't want the consequences, and good for you. But that leads us to another problem with grace, and that is that you don't deserve it and you can't earn it. And that's a problem. And again, that's not a problem with grace itself. That's a problem with how we as broken people interact with grace. And that brings us to point three, the person of grace. Because through this prayer, I want you to see where God, as the master author of this story, where he's situating Ezra and Nehemiah right now, and he's saying, okay, do you guys get it? You just rehearsed five cycles of this failure, and then your solution to it was to take a covenant to keep a covenant. Do you see now, at this point in redemptive history, you better prepare your hearts for a substitute who can come and do for you what none of you do. None of you. This is not a I'm religious versus I'm irreligious, or I've gone to seminary versus I haven't. None of us live this way well enough to qualify ourselves for God. And by the way, the people understand this. 9:29, I mean, it's in the middle of the prayer. You might just skim over it, but they're talking about, you know, our forefathers acted presumptuously and did not obey your commandments, but sinned against your rules. And they say, which if a person does them, he shall live by them. And you're right. If you just do them, you would live by them. Problem? The inverse is true. If you don't do them, they condemn you to die. The wages of sin is death. So the first thing we see here that Nehemiah is preparing us for is this person of grace. Because first of all, we need someone to live the life that we should have lived. See, if God is righteous as well as gracious, we need a law keeper. We need someone who can come and not just make empty promises that we hope in and then have our hopes dashed. We need someone who can come and say, you need someone to keep the law for you and put that on your account. And by the way, no founder of any world religion ever claimed to be sinless, let alone to be fulfilling righteousness for other people. No one ever claimed that except for Jesus. No world religion leader was like, look at me, I can save you. They're all saying, here's the eightfold path. Here's the five pillars. Here's the four aims. Here's the seven sacraments. Here's the this thing. And by the way, if you want to escape that by just, well, I'm a secular humanist, I don't believe in any God, I'm kind of like agnostic, sort of atheist, I can't figure it out. But read their secular humanist manifesto. They've got their list too. Here's what you got to do to be a good person. And we don't need a record and a list and a law to say, just do this and you'll live. Because if you hold it up yourself, what is the law? The New Testament says it's a mirror. And if you actually look in it for any length of time, you'll be like, ooh, I do not like the person I see when I start reading God's law. Because I've fallen so far short. Okay, so don't grovel. Just look to this person who lived the life you should have lived. Secondly, look to this person who died the death you should have died. I mean, do you understand what the cross, and we have a symbol of it here, but do you understand what the cross is all about? And maybe someone's here even this morning thinking, like, why the cross? Like, why did God have to literally kill his son? Why couldn't he just forgive us? If God is so wonderful, if he's so gracious and merciful, then why did he punish his son who was innocent? It just makes no sense. And the blood and the gore and the death and what you got back there for after the service where we're going to take communion together, it makes absolutely no sense. And these are all fair questions. Did God really have to kill his son? And I love what John Piper answers to this. He says, shedding the blood of the most valuable being in the universe is God's way of saying, this much I hate your sin. And this much I love my glory. Never think again that my mercy is cheap or that it ever conflicts with my righteousness. Once and for all, I have vindicated the worth of my name. My righteousness stands forever for everyone who trusts my son. The horrific brutality that Jesus endured is God's way of saying, yes, I kicked the can of justice down the road so that I could show you mercy. but there was a debt piling up and piling up and piling up and piling up. And I've used this illustration before. It's like a credit card. If you're sitting there and you know, like I'm at Home Depot and now I'm at King Supers and now I'm online shopping for some cool stuff on Amazon, and you know there's nothing behind this credit card, you know, like, well, then you're in trouble. Like, you're not supposed to do that, okay? Those swipes of a credit card, like you all know, you're not really, in some sense, you're not really paying right then. You're putting it on a list. And you better pay later, or it's going to hurt. Well, in the Old Testament, I mean, the people intuitively know. You're telling me I can put a hand on top of a cow's head and kill it and put it on an altar and God's happy with me? Well, yes and no. Because that's like a swipe of the credit card. And who's actually going to come and say, okay, that bill has come due. I have covered your sin, but now I'm going to wash it away. All of that went on Jesus. And in the cross, Jesus and God are showing us, this is how awful your sin is. This is, I never took it lightly. It's a debt. Somebody's got to pay that debt. How about I pay it for you? How about I take the death, the wrath, the rejection, the abandonment that you deserve so that I can give you mercy? And by the way, in the cross of Jesus, this is where, for the first time in history, the righteousness, the justice of God, and the mercy and grace of God met. And both were completely satisfied. So we don't have a God that's righteous and just and punishing people to the exclusion of mercy, but we also don't have a merciful God who's just like, it's no big deal. Well, it's a big deal because your sin is a debt and somebody's got to pay that debt. Romans 3, 25 and 26 says, God presented Christ as a sacrifice of atonement through the shedding of his blood to be received by faith. And if I just stop right there, what he's saying is God gave you his son to go to that cross to say, let me die to wash away the stain, to wash away the guilt, to wash away the presence and the power of sin over you and upon your life. Wash away the consequences. I'll take all of that. And he says, to be received by faith. In other words, you're not doing anything for God. He's like, I did it for you. Receive it. Just believe it. Going on, he says, he did this to demonstrate his righteousness. Because in his forbearance, he had left the sins committed beforehand unpunished. He's talking about the Old Testament. He's talking about the era that Christ lived for 33 years before he died. He's like, how did he forbear? How did he pass over sins and say, it's fine, I'll forgive you again. I'll forgive you again. I'll forgive you again. I'll forgive you again. Over and over. And there aren't just five cycles in the Old Testament. You know, there's dozens and dozens of them. How could he do that and be righteous? Romans 3 says, Jesus went to this cross to demonstrate his righteousness at the present time so as to be just. I'm righteous. I've punished sin. And the one who justifies those who have faith in Jesus. I've made you righteous. So never forget that God's grace has nothing to do with your performance. And it has everything to do with Jesus' performance for you. Which brings us to this last point, the practice of grace. Now what? Okay, so how do I respond if that's the message? If that's the good news, that, yeah, I'm broken. I don't need to hide the fact that I'm broken and sinful. I don't need to be ashamed and avoid other Christians and be like, nah, I can't go to church because everyone else is so put together. You know better. I know better. We're here because of the blood of Jesus. So how do we live in light of that? Number one, just confess your need of grace. A debtor to mercy is what everyone in this room is. It's what we all are. We're debtors to mercy. There's no shame in saying, I'm a debtor to mercy. So confess your need of it. And don't be afraid of circumstances in your life that are like that burr under the saddle. They're just rubbing you raw. And you're like, okay, God, I give up. I need grace. I don't want what I deserve. I don't want what's fair. I want mercy. See, because if you're like me, when life is just kind of hitting on all cylinders, things are wonderful, my relationships are wonderful, I feel like I'm really walking with God in some sense of that word, it is so easy to just kind of start to presume upon that grace and take it for granted and just think like it's all, God's always going to be kind because, you know, I'm a good person doing good things. But what happens when you're upended by trials and something really, really hurts and you realize the only way I can look is up because I've dug this big pit and for some reason I'm still shoveling? At that point in time, you realize I don't want what I deserve. This is the people in verse 33. They're confessing, you've been righteous in all that has come upon us, for you have dealt faithfully and we have acted wickedly. So what do you do when you're sitting there before God like, I've been wicked, I've been wrong, and you've been faithful? You're not going to ask for what you deserve at that point. You're going to ask for what Jesus deserves. It's grace. The old Scottish Presbyterian minister Samuel Rutherford used to say, grace grows best in winter. So don't be afraid when God sends winter into your life, because it might just be the thing that he wants to use to help you grow and not take something for granted. Grace grows best in winter. I think that's the theme of this prayer in chapter 9, that God let his people hit rock bottom time and time and time again so that they'd wake up and cry out and depend on what they knew they didn't deserve. Grace grows best in winter. You know, maybe you're mad at God this morning, or you know, you're super spiritual, so you would never say, I'm mad at God. You'd be like, I'm just disappointed. Mm-hmm. I'm just frustrated. Yeah, you're mad. Because he let you fall. He let you fail. But what if that letting you fall, letting you fail, was the mercy? Because it's letting you be in a place where you're like, I can't do it. I can't keep your law. I can't satisfy you on my own. Help. Because there's no one that's prayed a prayer like that, just as simple as that, that God didn't say, okay, I'm here to help. A different time, we were hiking up in Grand Lake with all of our kids, and our littlest guy was feeling it that day. I mean, he was just feeling really good. He was just charged down the trail, and there were a couple of steep sections with rocks, and there's, you know, if you've done this trail up above the East Inlet by the lake, there's a couple sections where the trail kind of goes up like this on this side and down like this on this side, and you have this little trail, you know. And when you're walking with a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old, you don't want them like tumbling to their death or, you know, into the creek and surviving. Like, you just want them to be on the trail. And they're little people, and they just don't make the best choices sometimes. And so they're, you know, they're talking and laughing and twirling while they walk along this little narrow thing. And so I'm like, son, you need to hold my hand. And he's like, well, no, I don't want to hold your hand. I don't need help. I don't need help. I don't need help. I don't need help. So finally, I let him go. I want you to know that when I let him go beside that, it wasn't like, fine, have a good fall. You're kind of trying to figure out his pace where he feels like I'm doing it all by myself. And you're kind of like figuring out that pace. And I'm right behind him with this arm ready to just shoot out and catch him from falling down the mountain into the creek. So to his perspective, it's like, I can do this. I got this. And from my perspective, it's like, maybe you do, maybe you don't. I want you to know, like, later on that same hike, he fell, skinned up his knees and stuff. And he was hurt. But I want you to understand, he was not harmed. And I think this is like our Father with us. He's going to let you get hurt. When you want to go do your own thing, he will not allow you to suffer harm. And there's a difference, because that hurt is very often what is like, okay, I do want to hold your hand. I do need help. I can't do it on my own. So just confess it. Fine, I need grace. Walk in light of the grace you've received. If you've received grace, and most of you would say that you have, now let your daily choices be driven, be motivated by the kindness of God, that you're every day like, I'm still amazed by grace. I still know I didn't deserve that. There's this thing with modern medicine that's really incredible, where people can be clinically dead and we resuscitate them. My own paternal grandfather was dead after open heart surgery, was resuscitated, and went on to live many more years after that. Now imagine if my grandfather just lay in his easy chair all day, every day. I'm not going to talk to my grandkids. I'm not going to acknowledge my wife. I'm not going to eat unless it's like miserable. I'm just going to be right here. What are you doing? Well, I should be dead, so I'm just going to act as dead as possible. And you'd be like, that's kind of backwards. You kind of got a second opportunity at life. So don't you want to go live in light of the life that you have? But how many times spiritually is that kind of what we're doing as Christians, where Jesus is like, you were dead in your trespasses and sins. I have made you alive together with Christ. And we go back and we're like, well, and we're submitting our members to do this walk of death. Hey, if you're alive in Christ, you got new life, you got eternal life, walk like it. Okay? So I'm not talking about this rebellious response where you're just like, you know, I'm going to use the grace of God to justify and excuse my sin because God's grace is so abundant. And I know people who live like that. They're sinning their brains out and they're like, you can't say I'm not a Christian. I just believe in grace. No, you're a rebel. But you can also be overly self-righteous, religious, where you're like, no, I can't really accept grace. And what you're doing is you're trying to leverage and manipulate and control God by your righteousness. I don't want a free gift from God. I'm a good person doing good things. Well, you need a free gift from God. Get over yourself. You're not that good. And in between this rebellious response and this religious response is the gospel. And I do think that's what you see in chapter 10. That the people aren't recommitting their lives to God in order to earn God's favor. They're recommitting their lives to God because they know they have God's favor. And that order is very important. Their entire prayer is saying, we understand we're back in this cycle, and but for your grace, we would have been destroyed. But you've sent us men like Ezra and Nehemiah. You've sent us new Levites and prophets to raise us up and rebuild. This is all your kindness. What are we going to do in response to that kindness? We're going to try to walk in light of it. And friends, this is the only reasonable way to respond to the cross of Jesus. You know, to ignore what he says, I did this for you, is just foolish. But to scorn it by, you're like, no, I can't really trust that. I can't put my eggs in that basket. I'm going to work to earn it. I want to do my part. Well, you don't have a part. What you contributed to your salvation was the sin that made it necessary. And then you said, help. And he did. There's this heresy today that says that any efforts at a high degree of intentionality to obey God, that's just legalism. You've probably heard it. Maybe you've even said it. You're just a legalist. You're trying to obey the word of God, it's just legalism. You know, Titus 2 says the grace of God trains us to renounce ungodliness and worldly passions and to live self-controlled, upright, and godly lives in the present age. And we say this often, that the Christian order of this is so important. It is not, I obey, therefore God accepts me. It is, God accepted me by free grace, therefore I obey. And that therefore I obey is what the Christian life looks like. It's not, God accepted me by free grace, so it doesn't matter how I live. Rebellious. It does matter. But you're responding to God's kindness. You're not earning it. You know, you want to see this as parents. I did something kind for you. I did something gracious. You didn't have to buy my love by your obedience, but I would like you, for your own sake and for our relationship, for you to be obedient. So let me just close with this. I'll just kind of end how I began. So if you've ever made those kind of promises of like, God, I really, really, really mean it this time, okay? I know I'm sinning and I'm frustrated with this. I feel filthy. I feel gross. I want to be free of this. So I'm praying again. I'm saying, I confess that this was wrong, and I really mean it this time. I'm going to keep your word. If your hope is on the strength and the sincerity of your promise to God, you may feel like every day I am climbing and climbing and climbing this ladder, and I'm making progress, but I will tell you, your ladder's leaned up against the wrong wall. So you're getting somewhere, but you're getting nowhere, because you may get to the top and realize, oh, oops, I'm supposed to be over there, building my life on the grace and the foundation of Jesus. So this story about our little guy who, I can do it on my own. I can do it on my own. Don't touch me. Don't help me. I fall. I get hurt. the way that story concludes is he wasn't then like, hey, okay, fine, you can hold my hand. He said, will you carry me? And if the God that we encounter in this prayer is the God of the Bible, it's the real God, it's the God that we worship again and still this morning, this is not the kind of God you bring in to be a consultant on your life. God, I have it kind of all figured out, but there's a couple areas I just need some prayer. And that's how we use God. I have it mostly figured out with my job, my relationships, my finances, all this stuff. But I need a favor every once in a while. I need some advice. And he's like the cosmic Dear Abby. God, I need some wisdom. So we use the Bible word. And he's like, I just need advice on something. Well, you don't need advice. You need God. And you need the grace of God. So let's give ourselves to that. Let's do like our little guy and say, not only do I not want to do it on my own, and not only do I want you to kind of hold my hand while I do it on my own, God, will you carry me through this life so that my life is an honor to your name?